Our guest now is an author, a stand-up comedian and a classicist, Natalie Haynes. And we're doing a deep dive into Greek mythology, but not necessarily as you know it or have been taught it. A self-confessed nerd, the teenage Haynes embraced Latin and ancient Greek before going on to study classics under the famed Professor Mary Baird. Moving between the macho world of comedy and the male-dominated world of the classics, she began retelling the stories we thought we knew about ancient Greece. Her feminist take on the famous Greek myths rebalances the scales, giving us a woman's perspective on the tales for so long retold by men. A hugely popular Radio 4 series, Natalie Haynes stands up for the classics, and seven books later, she's become an acclaimed classicist and has been described as a rock star mythologist. And the latest book is Divine Might, Goddesses in Greek Myth. It continues her work of re-evaluating the characters and stories so often left out. Natalie will be speaking at the Auckland Writers Festival next month. She's with us from London. Great to talk. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's lovely to talk to you.
I love the comment you've made that your parents got the daughter they deserved. There's another book.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the beginning, because I think I think your origin story is important. This, you know, energy and passion and ability. Does it go back to very early life, Natalie?
Yes, I had really good teachers. I was very lucky. So I started studying Latin at 11, I think, or 12. And then I started doing ancient Greek at 14. I really wasn't a nerd from the get-go, but I wasn't a very small child nerd. My brother remembers that we had a puffin book of Greek myth, I think. I don't remember that at all. My first encounter that I remember with Medusa, who I wrote a whole novel about, so it was obviously cast a long shadow, was Clash of the Titans with Harry Hamlin as Perseus and a clockwork owl. So yeah, I wasn't always as highbrow about myth as I became with time. So basically, I am always here for Disney Hercules, is what I'm saying.
Medusa, we're going to return to her story, because that's a classic example, if you'll pardon the pun.
I will pardon it. I encourage it, in fact.
of your work. Studying the significance of studying Latin and ancient Greek, particularly when you come to this work of going back to the source material, just how important is it to have that ability?
It's really lucky if you do, certainly. I mean, the teaching of ancient languages in the UK is really not exclusively, but almost exclusively in private schools. And that's only 7% of students. We get a bit more classics in translation, classical civilization, as it's called, in the state sector. But the learning of ancient languages has essentially been cordoned off from most students. And so you can certainly learn classics from scratch at university without having done Latin or Greek at lots and lots of universities now, precisely because they obviously want to open it out and make it less of an elite, a clique of people who can study it. But I would be lying if I said it wasn't a huge bonus for me, a huge boost, that I can go back to the Greek, go back to the Latin and read essentially the sources as they were written 2,000 or 2,500 years ago, with changes of the way we have manuscripts and things, but even so. And I don't have to have these things sort of filtered through the prism of somebody who might have translated a text in the 19th century or the 20th century or even the 21st century, when you'll be astonished to hear there is still some not very thoughtful misogyny going on.
This gets right to the heart of what you've learned and what you've shared, which is that the reinterpretation throughout the ages says more about the interpreter and the age than it does the original.
Often. That's often true. So the example that we might look at is Hippolyta. Hippolyta, the Amazon warrior. When I was growing up, the version of this story that I had was that Heracles, obviously to give him his Greek name, but we usually use the Roman version, Hercules, goes off on one of his labors to claim Hippolyta's girdle. And even growing up, I was like, what does that even mean? You know, like my grandmother's generation wore girdles. But it was only when I had to read Midsummer Night's Dream, I think, at school, that I realized that a girdle could also be like a belt, an ungendered belt, a plain leather belt, because Puck says he'll put a girdle around the earth, I think. But the thing is, when you go to the Greek, the word for an ungendered belt, a plain belt, is zerne, and the word for a man's belt, a war belt, a belt worn on the battlefield by, for example, Agamemnon, the leader of the Greeks in the Iliad, is zoster. And every single source that I could find that writes who writes about Hippolyta and her war belt uses that word, zoster. And every single translation I could find, I mean, just maybe a dozen of them translated it as either girdle or belt. And it's like, she is the daughter of the god of war of Ares. He gave her the war belt. It's a war belt. Stop trying to feminize her when that's not in the Greek. It's just so my constant refrain is, I'm afraid that's just not in the Greek. And that is often how I feel it. I understand that the appeal is to make it seem like there's a sort of sexual tension between Hercules and Hippolyta, because for sure in some versions of the story there is one. But it's like he's not going after her undergarments. He's going after her war belt. They're tremendous innovators in war, Amazons. They invent the battle axe. So they're really impressive and really cool, and it sort of reduces them to suggest that they're not, exactly as well equipped on the battlefield as men.
I'm just pausing and thinking we're sort of going through another era of that now. And we'll come to the whole question of feminism where, I don't know, can I bring up Top Gun here? The original Top
Why
Gun,
wouldn't you? Why would you ever not bring up Top Gun?
the
I
original
am
Top
here for this all day long.
The original Top Gun and the P take that it
Yes.
was of, in many ways, of kind of the Air Force top brass and everything that
Yes,
went
and
on there,
hypermasculinity, as we might call it.
and the fact that the love interest was actually an astrophysicist and knew more than the
Yes.
guys flying the planes. If you look at the latest version, no offense to people who work in bars, everyone has and should at some point, and they and you know, it's a precious job for people like me, but that's not the person in the most powerful position in that movie. And yet that's the love interest, and the whole thing has become like this kind of worship of US military and this worship of the whole point of that film has been rewritten, and the relegation of women in many contemporary roles to the romantic love interest and the support act. We just go through these
Yes.
cycles, don't we?
Yeah, and I mean the 90s, which is when I was first sort of going to the cinema on my own, I suppose, was a really terrible decade for film in lots of ways. It's a brilliant decade for film. There were loads of really great films, but it was a really appalling era for men going off and having adventures while women go, "Oh, but be careful," as they leave. That's their whole role in the film. And eventually I came up with a rule that I would no longer watch either a film or a TV show in which female characters didn't have a job unless it was waitress, which, like you, it's like I
Respect, full
didn't mind at
respect.
all being a waitress. I didn't mind working in a shop, didn't mind waiting tables. It wasn't everything I wanted from my life forever. It was what I wanted to do when I was young to make some money. So if you are a, female character opposite men who have these really intense careers that we're supposed to invest in a film, and your role is basically to bring them some coffee, or alternatively to be a prostitute, brackets, often dead, close brackets, then I have a problem with that film or that TV show. Because is that really all you can imagine? I remember noticing it really, really strongly and angrily when the TV show True Detective began. Do you remember that? And they basically solved crimes both in the present as it was then, and also I think the 1990s. And it's like the people writing it couldn't imagine that women had jobs in the 90s other than prostitute. You're like, dude, your sister was in, had a job in the 90s. Your mother had a job. I had a job in the 90s. I promise you, there were other jobs available for women then. But it's like they couldn't imagine women as whole people, who might have ambitions or goals of their own. So it was just easier if they gave them, the least ambition or the least
Or
potential
the
career
male,
development ahead of them,
or the
while
fact,
men solved problems and had adventures. It was so tiresome.
yes, or the male, some males' fantasies, not the ones I
Yeah, if
associate
you
with,
want to
but
make an entire film about a waitress, for example, the film waitress, then I have absolutely no problem with that. If the scale of your drama is what happens in her life, both in her workplace and beyond it, that's absolutely fine. If it's an adventure story in which a woman brings some men coffee and then tells them to be careful, then I'm afraid you haven't done quite well enough, and I'd like you to go back and do it again.
So come back to Hippolyta, because what occurs with her
Yes.
story and others is not, it's not that the original author wrote it this way, which is what we're kind of ripping into at the moment. It's that it was subverted somewhere along the way
Yes,
by others.
absolutely.
Give us
Yeah,
a
I mean, we have a bunch of ancient sources. It's very hard to know if there is ever an original version. All we have is the earliest version that we've got. We've lost more than 90% of ancient Greek literature, so it's definitely not going to be the earliest that there was. But how interesting to watch how these stories get changed through time. I mean, the most egregious is Pandora, I suppose. Pandora has a pithos, a jar in Greek. In some versions, not all of her story. In some versions, not all, the jar is opened. Sometimes Pandora does it, sometimes her husband does it, sometimes it just becomes open. But as soon as Erasmus mistranslates the word pithos to pyxis, jar to box, then Pandora suddenly has a box. You look at a jar in ancient Greek times, very narrow at the base, widens out a really long way, really unstable. Don't put all the world's evils in there. That's a terrible idea. They don't even have screw tops. What are you thinking? And you kind of it looks like a much more potentially innocent mistake. But what happens after, a couple of, well, of 1500 years of Christianity, where Eve particularly has been, made the villain of the story of how women begin. Pandora, the first woman for the Greeks, Eve, obviously the first woman in Genesis. And what's happened then is that, if Eve is guilty for doing terrible things, then Pandora must be guilty of doing terrible things. So Pandora's now got a box. She's opening it deliberately. There's artworks really shortly after Erasmus makes this error, which show her, opening a thing covered in skulls, human skulls. Okay, this all looked like it got a bit, angry a bit quickly. But Pandora is another victim of mistranslation. She never has a box until Erasmus. So, yeah, 2,000 years after the earliest version of her story in Hesiod, where she doesn't even have a jar, I might add, in the Theogony, then, yeah, we get this version, and that's the version that everyone knows.
And we still talk about not opening Pandora's box.
We absolutely do still do that. And we always call Helen of Sparta, as she actually is, Helen of Troy, even though the tradition of Helen not going to Troy, but instead going to Egypt, is at least as old as Homer, the earliest source to tell us that she goes to Troy. So, yeah, there is a blameless version of Helen's story where she goes off to Egypt, doesn't have an affair with anyone, and she still gets blamed for the Trojan War because the gods send an image, an eidolon, that looks exactly like her and that they've animated to Troy instead. So everyone fights in exactly the same way. They blame her the entire time. And then at the end of the war, when the Greeks finally get their hands on her, she disappears into the breath she was made of. Oh, it's the most extraordinary metaphor for the futility of war. But that version is never remembered and never retold. We only have the version where a beautiful woman runs off with a handsome man and causes a war.
So even Homer's not beyond this stuff, and
I mean, everyone does it. So Homer didn't know he would be the only one who survived to us from that era, I suppose, apart from Hesiod. So, yeah, he does a version of the story where she goes to Troy, but perhaps there's another version by another person we might have also once called Homer, because it's a name that gets applied to more than one poet, almost certainly. And, here we are, that we lost one and we kept the other. We would have a great version of the Amazons fighting in Troy if a poem called The Aethiopis had survived, but instead, we don't have that, so we don't have that story and we forget about them.
it's also a lesson about not worshipping even the ancients who were brilliant, and whether they were one or two or three people or others. I had a recent oh my goodness, the name's not going to come to me. A recent wonderful expert on who explained to me, it was about a particular city, and that's going to come to me as well. Explained to me Aristotle had used the phrase about slaves, a man-footed animal. And, we can make heroes, again, please pardon the unintended references to classics. We can make heroes out of people who, in the end, are just people. And were people in their times, and Yes, their work has remained throughout antiquity, whomever they were. But we ought not hero worship, and they ought not certainly be beyond scrutiny. You've got some more contemporary scholars in your sights, well and truly, as well. And in more recent times, who would you say, or what examples would you give about an interpretation of these ancient texts that is, to quote you, that's not in the Greek?
Well, let's go for one that's not in the Latin for a change. So there's a female poet called Sulpicia who writes in the first century BCE. So she's the approximate contemporary of the Emperor Augustus. That's Brian Blessed if you still use I Claudius as your way of measuring who is which emperor, and I will not judge you, of course. We have, I think, six poems written by Sulpicia. They're very short, between 2 and 8 lines long. And they're just lovely. You know, there's one where she's really cross because it's her stupid birthday. And she's annoyed about it. Her Inuesa's birthday, the birthday I don't even want, she calls it. And she's annoyed because her uncle is taking her out of Rome for the day for a treat. But of course, she would rather stay in Rome because that's where her handsome young boyfriend is. So she doesn't want to go on a lovely treat. It won't be a treat for her. And for the longest time, very, very clever, very old, now dead men in the 19th and early 20th century decided that these poems could not have been written by a woman. Because essentially that they couldn't imagine that a woman ever had an education enough to write such things, even though there was archaeological evidence which suggests that, you know, plenty of women, not every woman, not every girl, was learning basic literacy, but plenty would. And then they decided that the poetry was too good for it to be by a woman. So it must have in fact been by Tibullus, a male poet, in disguise in these poems as a woman, because some poets wrote kind of monologues in, like Ovid's Heroides, where he writes letters through the voices of women from myth. So that must be what's going on here. Never mind that she wasn't a woman from myth. She was a sort of ordinary, quite posh Roman girl. But that must have been the answer, because it couldn't be anything else. And then because she expresses sexual desire for her handsome young man, they decided it was too rude for a woman to have written it. And so it must have been written by a man, because a woman would never think that. And you just had visions of these perfectly nice, not trying to be appalling men, sitting there going, well, my wife would never write this. And you're like, I'm sure she wouldn't, mate. But unfortunately for you, that's not all of women. That's just one woman, your wife. And so for a really long time, Sulpicia wasn't sort of considered as a female poet at all, because, you know, she can't possibly have written these poems that are attributed to her. So that's the sort of thing that you have going on. And then you get reappraisals and things kind of swing back around. And so, you know, these things are always open to change. We've got 3 Sappho poems, or relatively complete Sappho poems, and then a bunch of fragments. But Sappho wrote 9 books of lyric poetry, and one of those 3 poems has only been discovered and revealed in our lifetime. It was publicized in 2014. So, you know, we immediately gained a huge percentage more Sappho in one day. So who knows what we'll find next. There are constant advances in science. So people are now making a really good go at reading carbonized scrolls from Herculaneum, which previously couldn't be read without damaging them beyond repair. And so who knows what we'll find next, but never. I always like to travel hopefully in terms of there being more women's work to be found, because it probably is out there, and eventually we might find a little bit more.
Well, I hate to say it, but we might need to train the dreaded AI to translate from the ancient
It's Greek. Already doing it.
Is it?
Yeah, it's already doing it. Yeah, there was a large cash prize was put up for exactly that process to be done. And I think the first word they found in one of these carbonized scrolls that can't be opened was porphyry. Who knows what we'll find next. But yeah, I find it one of those really weird things about contemporary life, that certainly in terms of like educational funding, we seem to pit the arts and the sciences against each other, when actually we really do all need each other. Lucky us, lucky classicists, that we've got some different kinds of nerd to come and help us out with.
Natalie Haynes, our guest.
Yes.
Natalie Haynes, our guest. Divine Might, Goddesses and Greek Myth is her latest book. Couple more to finish. We mustn't, one more story. We mustn't end without talking about Medusa, which is another example of the kind of contortions over time.
Yeah, absolutely. So Gorgons, and specifically Gorgon heads, Gorgonea, were incredibly popular in ancient times. We see them as protective devices. Apotropaic is the proper word, I suppose. So they avert evil from you. And we think of them as being a Gorgon head has snaky hair, often. Not always, though. There's a beautiful vase painting in the Metropolitan Museum in New York, which shows Medusa with beautiful black ringlets instead. But the earlier the image, generally the more strange and grotesque and mask-like it is. So they often then will have tusks, the snaky hair, perhaps also we might see a resemblance to a lion's mane with this sort of big mass of hair. They often have very, very wide mouths and the tongue is sticking out. So you know that they're making a loud noise. And here again, a case in point of translation. The noise that Gorgons make is a goon in Greek, which means like a wordless cry, a shout. And it's always translated as like baleful dirge or something like that. And correspondingly, the Greek hero Diomedes in the Iliad, he is always given the describer. Diomedes of the loud war cry, or I've got one translation somewhere in my small flat, which is roughly drowning in books. Diomedes, master of the war cry. And yet in Greek, Diomedes, good at shouting. So you see how he has been heroized for being noisy, and she has been monsterized by being noisy. Those are the different ways we treat them. But yes, Medusa is not a monster. And I am ashamed to say that I didn't realize until I wrote about her in Pandora's Jar. Which was published in 2020. She never murders anyone. She never kills anyone with her ability to turn you to stone. Her head is used after she has been killed to turn lots of people to stone. But I think we can all agree that is simply not the same thing at all. When she's alive and she has agency, she doesn't turn anyone to stone, which raises the question, how doesn't she? And that was why I wrote a novel about her, because I thought, imagine having the power to kill anything you look at. Firstly, how would you keep everyone you care about safe? And secondly, that must be the loneliest life imaginable because you would never be able to look at anything you cared about. So I wrote her a novel.
And how poignant is that?
Yeah, really
Truer
sad,
to
isn't
the original. To your point earlier, a lot of these reinterpretations, if you can call them that, they're just errors in some instances, have an undertone to them, don't they?
Yes, I mean, I think often it doesn't come from a place of malice, but it does come from a failure to perhaps assess what your assumptions are in the time that you are writing, if you see what I mean. So when people ask me if or why I write feminist versions of these myths, the answer is because this is who I am and it's the 21st century. So everything I write is going to be feminist at some level or another because I think women are the same thing as people and that's really all it takes. And so I think. You know, as I say, there were people writing these versions of myths in the 19th and 20th century and you know, even into the 21st century, who weren't trying to disadvantage women. They weren't trying to romanticize sexual assault, although they often did do that because they didn't think about it very carefully from multiple perspectives. So what you see is if you focus your narrative on, for example, Theseus, you know, he's so heroic, he kills the Minotaur. Well, that's he's only heroic if you're not on the side of the Minotaur, you know. And if you are on the side of the Minotaur, then and Borges wrote a short story called The House of Asterion, I don't know, 50, 60 years ago, which sees the Minotaur's perspective and sees it the story very differently. That's the first version of a Greek myth spun like that, where the monster was turned into not a monster that I remember reading. And for sure, it's been a hugely influential
There's
story for me.
a lot to there's so much to draw on this, and
There's so much.
your love of popular culture is your love of art. We've only barely touched on. You alluded to it earlier. It's not just the text; it's the art as well. But we've talked on popular culture. You were a stand-up comedian doing the stuff, and you mentioned Disney earlier. So
Yes.
let's just finish with how we bring classics to the 2024 generation, the very visual generation that this is, rather than pouring through, the original Greek, and the kind of TikTok generation. What are the ways of righting the ship,
Yeah.
and using the power of these myths, What are the ways this can happen, including rewriting some of the misinterpretations, or at least bringing forward the different interpretations?
Well, I think if we're going to discuss the TikTok generation, then where better to go than with two music videos? The first, a version of Lady Gaga's Venus, in which she sings about Venus as both a planet and also an entity, a goddess. The music video, which was shot at Hearst Castle, I think, is just the most fantastically huge and kitsch extravaganza. She's got the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, I think, pretending to play instruments, dancers going. It's absolutely incredible. It's huge budget production. And what I love about it is not just that there's that version, which you should definitely watch, but that she also did a Thanksgiving special, I think, on American television, in which she recreated it with the Muppets as her dancers. And it's like, well, how much more metatextual could we get than that? That's just exactly what I want to see. I want to see what it looks like when Lady Gaga takes on the ancient goddess of love and then reperforms it in the company of the Muppets. And even more than that, perhaps, is the music video for Rumours, Lizzo and Cardi B, which plays on the visuals of Disney Hercules. And they are dressed in, let's say, fantastically racy outfits, and not go further than that, because I don't want you to get taken off air for the rest of your lives. But certainly Cardi B is wearing a magnificent pair of earrings, which I very much recommend you look at closely and then ask a young person what they might mean.
But everyone will do now.
I would certainly hope so. But how amazing to see these contemporary performers claiming classics for themselves. You know, this isn't something that now belongs to the pale, male and stale, which is what people always used to say about classics when I was first studying it. This is two women of colour presenting themselves as both goddesses and architecture. At one point, you know, they're wearing sort of columns or capitals, the top of a column, as headgear. It's absolutely majestic. And you kind of think, well, this is exactly what classics should be doing. It should be inspiring everyone. There's a unbelievable Beyoncé video where it looks exactly like she is taking on the story of Medea, at least to me. But I can see that's open to interpretation. With Lizzo and Cardi B, there is no messing about. They are deliberately, jokily referencing themselves as Greek goddesses. I'm here for it all day long.
No surprise. Very, very quickly, before I let you go, I mean, we just muck it up all the time. It wasn't calling a spade a spade. It was calling a canoe a canoe.
It was calling a canoe a canoe. Yeah, absolutely. So the word in Greek is skaphos. It's like a hollowed out thing. And so, yes, another really fun mistranslation. So, yeah, if you want to tell people that someone is really blunt and down to earth, you should say, yeah, she likes to call a canoe a canoe. And then just look really seriously at the deadpan as though everyone else has always said it that way and they've just been wrong the whole time, and never make mention of it again. I'm confident we could just create a lot of paranoia by doing this. And, you know, it's only quite a small paranoia. It's a little bit mean, but I think we should all enjoy ourselves.
Doesn't have the same ring about it. Natalie, thank you very much. Natalie Haynes, Divine Mates, the latest book, Goddesses and Greek Myth.